when it comes to the conflict right now, the economic conflict between the United States and China, many people are asking, what is the main strategy? What's your take, Michael? Let's start with you. What's your take on the way that the Trump administration is trying to talk about the strategy on their part? Even we've heard that CNN was reporting with talking with GOP Senator Ron Johnson. He said he has no idea what is the strategy. What's your take on that, Michael?
Well, when Besant said that China had an unbalanced economy, what it meant was that it was successful. And him, for his idea, a balanced economy is one without any government, and ideally, for Trump, without any income tax. But that's not how China looks at it. China believes it's a mixed public-private economy, with the government playing the same kind of active role that it played in the United States industrial takeoff in the 19th century. And that it played in Germany's takeoff, and earlier in British mercantilism. The China knows that it already is the central provider and refiner of many raw materials that the West needs, and that if indeed it says we're not going to be bullied, which is what its foreign minister has said, we're not going to negotiate. When somebody says, we're going to hurt you if you don't want what we say, we're going to raise tariffs and prevent you from trade, China's gone rope-a-dope. It says, okay, we're on with that. You want to balance the trade more with us? Well, we're stopping our exports to you of critical materials. We're stopped. We have a whole list of products that we're not going to send to you. These are the products that your industry needs. Without importing from China, American industry, after a few months of depleting its reserves of parts, pharmaceuticals, various chemicals, raw materials, the American economy will have to stop producing. And China has said, well, we're now going to need licenses to get the critical materials that we can produce. And China has the ability to stop, interrupt America's production relations and assembly lines and just stop things. So it says, fine. But I talk often with Chinese policymakers, and they're their view is not that they will lose from the United States, but they think the United States is committing economic suicide. And mostly they think that America is going to end up the loser in this tariff war because it doesn't have an industrial policy. Simply imposing tariffs isn't industrial policy. It merely makes it more expensive for companies to import from their affiliates automobile parts from Canada and Mexico, as we've discussed in past programs, but also telephones and iPhones made by Amazon that are made there, shoes from Vietnam that are imported by the big shoe company, screws, all sorts of things. And China sees above all that, you know, why is America not recognizing why China has been so successful in developing what Americans call unbalanced? And that is because China has kept public infrastructure in the public domain. It hasn't let it be privatized. And the most important public utility that it's kept, that neither America nor other Western countries have kept in the public domain, is money. China doesn't have a domestic financial class that makes money by speculating and buying out other companies, buying out industry and deindustrializing, or deciding, let's find a cheaper way of doing this to lower the wage costs and make more profits. The whole aim of China is what used to be the aim of the United States, Germany, and other countries. You raise wages in order to increase productivity, and you provide basic infrastructure to provide basic needs, electricity, communications, you know, railroads, at cost or at a subsidized rate, so that the industrial companies don't have to pay their labor high enough wages to afford this services that are monopolized in the United States. So China has made finance part of the industrial growth pattern, and Trump and the United States is not, and Trump doesn't realize why China is developing, but America isn't. He simply says they're developing and we're not. They're ahead of us, and that makes them the rival. We have to stop them. He doesn't say, why don't we're doing what China's doing? Why don't we follow their model that's made them so successful? And the irony is that this model that has made China so successful is exactly the same model that the United States followed in the 19th century to develop its industrial takeoff. It's a model that Germany followed in the 19th century to follow its takeoff. There's a certain logic of how do you industrialize? And you industrialize with a mixed economy, and you take the banking system and you use it to finance industrial development, not to create monopolies and create trusts and essentially try to make money at the expense of industry and the rest of the economy. There's no recognition of an industrial policy to back up industrial tariffs. So the result is that Trump thinks that he'll win the war with China, and the Chinese say, well, we're looking at who's trading what and who needs what. If he wants to do that, let's let him go right ahead and do what he's doing, and we'll see where the American economy stands in 3 months.
Richard.
Well, you know, just to piggyback off what Michael said, it's embarrassing. I listened to that clip of our Treasury Secretary, and it's embarrassing what comes out of that man's mouth. I mean, I'm beyond words almost, but let me try. Why is he calling what the Chinese do somehow self-evident? They're technically smart people, he said that, are aware that they shouldn't be doing this, what they're doing. Let me remind everyone, 70 years ago, China was among the poorest countries on this planet. It was an exemplar of the depth of poverty. It was the place that Pearl Buck described in her book, The Good Earth, as almost beyond human suffering, the level of difficulty for their people. And over the last 75 years, and particularly over the last 30 or 35 years, they have become one of the economic powerhouses of the modern world. Why in the world would you want to call that not what it is, what Michael says, success? Of course it's success. They've become the manufacturing center of the world in that period of time. It blows my mind. I recently saw a map of bullet trains in China, the complex network of their super fast trains. The only thing in the United States that comes close is the Acela, the train line that runs from Boston to Washington, which is only slightly faster than the convention. We basically have no bullet trains. And they've connected every place in China with bullet trains. By the way, Michael reminds us, what was the big breakthrough of the 19th century? The trains, which unified the country, which opened up the Midwest to the rest of the world so it could become the food producer, the grain producer, transforming everybody else. The Chinese are the success story of our time. You know, earlier government administrations in the United States wanted to make the Chinese change their regime, change their system. We justified bringing them into the World Trade Organization because that was going to make them like us. But there's no reason for them to be like us. They don't want to have slow economic growth. In 2024, according to the IMF, U.S. economic growth about 2.8%, Chinese economic growth about 5%. And now I know there'll be the conventional nonsense about how you can't trust Chinese numbers. I have heard that story uninterrupted for 30 years. Now it's beginning to fade away since obviously it was nonsense all along and it's nonsense now. And by the way, those are IMF numbers, not numbers from China. So the crucial reality here is that it's the American government that's in trouble. It's the American empire that's declining, and it's the American capitalist system that has dug itself into a hole. If for the last 40, 50 years, you have run a trade imbalance, which we basically have since the 1970s, and you've paid for it by a massive export of dollars that come back as debt, you're deepening a level of debt that will one day lead people to hesitate to absorb more debt. That's what happened on Monday of this week. That's why the bond market freaked them all out. Look, it destroyed a British government two or three prime ministers ago when she, the woman, Liz Truss, when she tried to push beyond the level of debt that people will give London, crippling that economy still further. They're in trouble here. And the imposition of tariffs, I mean, let me take another way of getting it. The President of the United States declared economic war on the whole rest of the world by a tariff on every country, with a handful of exceptions. Nobody has ever done that before. What is this? This is not a sign of a calm, collected. This is desperation economics. And if you doubted it, the on again, off again just shows you how desperate they are. 2 days of something, Monday it has to be reversed because the bond market goes crazy. And then Wednesday it has to be reversed because our allies are going to hurt us back. The Chinese showing it, even the Europeans, courageless as they so often nowadays are thinking maybe to find some resort. But this is not the United States of the 20th century. This is the United States going down and flailing around with these gestural policies on again, off again. Wow. This is, and the whole world, one last point, the whole world has been given a gift. My old teacher, Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, would have told me to expect this. Mr. Trump attacks the world for cheating and hopes it will get him by doing what he's doing. What he has given is a gift to every other leader of every other country who will now be able to point to the economic problems of his or her country and blame Mr. Trump. He has taught them. And there'll be a grain of truth to it because the tariffs make a difference, hurt people in his country, and they're going to yell in every country. And their leaders are going to have to blame someone, and Mr. Trump has shown them how to do that. Blame him. And there'll be more truth to their doing that than there was to Mr. Trump, who initiated it. As Mr. Hegel would have said, his plan was to burden the rest of the world and make them pay for the problems he has. His result, they will blame him. The opposite is buried right in what he did. And he doesn't seem to understand any of that and he keeps doing it. 90 days were to wait. In other words, the uncertainty of the last few weeks will now be for the next 3 months. What? May, June, July, nobody knows how to make an investment, where to make it. You won't know what the supply chains are because you don't know where the tariffs will or will not be, or for how long they'll be, or for what height. How do you make a decision? You don't. You wait. And as Mr. Keynes told us, when the employer class waits, we all discover how capitalism makes the mass of us hostage to what the few of us do with their profits. If they don't roll them over and spend them, we're screwed. And suddenly, what are we looking at? Stagnation from the holding back, from the uncertainty, coupled with inflation from the tariffs, and we get that stagflation horror that comes back to haunt us. This is chaotic economic policy born of desperation, whose likely outcome is going to be a lot of trouble.
I don't think it's born of desperation at all. Trump is not desperate. He is quite confident that he has a solution to the problem. And I think if we take a step back, we realize that this whole tariff issue isn't really about tariffs at all. Trump and the Republicans have one political aim above all others, and that's what is behind what he's doing. They want to cut taxes, above all for the progressive taxation that falls mainly on the highest incomes and on personal wealth. And it seems that at some point, Trump must have asked some economists whether there was any alternative way for governments to finance themselves. He said, how do we cut taxes? What can we do? And somebody must have told him that actually, from the time of American independence in 1776, all the way through the eve of World War I, by far the dominant form of government revenue was customs revenue from tariffs. So you can see that a light bulb went off in Trump's brain. Tariffs don't fall on his own rentier class of real estate, financial, and monopoly billionaires. Tariffs fall primarily on labor, also on industry for imports of necessary raw materials and parts. But the whole idea of introducing tariffs is, he said, the more tariff revenues we can raise, the more income taxes we can cut. And right now, before Congress, the Republicans and Trump are saying it's time to renew all of the vast tax cuts that Trump enacted in his first administration. That is what pushed the U.S. Budget into deficit to begin with. Trump claims that tariffs can enable the United States to keep his tax cuts and replace the taxes. And he wants to cut taxes even more on the wealthiest classes, as if somehow this is going to create an incentive for the wealthiest classes, the financial classes, the monopolists, the real estate people, to rebuild American industry. It's as if giving more wealth to the financial managers, they're the ones who've deindustrialized the American economy. Giving them more money will simply repeat the industrial takeoff that was peaking in the 1890s under the president that Trump idealizes, William McKinley. Well, what his narrative leaves out of account is that tariffs were merely the precondition for nurturing industry by the government in a mixed public-private economy, just like China has a mixed public-private economy. The government shaped markets in ways that were designed to minimize the cost of living and doing business. And that public nurturing is what gave the United States its competitive international advantage in industry. But given Trump's guiding economic aim to untax himself and his most influential political constituency, what appeals to him is simply the fact that government didn't have an income tax. It was able to finance itself through tariffs. Why can't it do it today? And it's as if all that enabled America's remarkable industrial takeoff to occur was cutting tariffs. And also, what appeals to Trump is the super affluence of a robber baron class, in whose rank he can imagine he thinks of himself as joining the ranks of the robber barons. And this self-indulgent class consciousness has a blind spot regarding how its own drives and predatory income and wealth destroy the economy around it. It's as if the robber barons made money by organizing and driving industry. Trump is unaware that the Gilded Age of the 1890s did not emerge as part of America's industrial strategy for success, or that the great fortunes were made possible by the failure to regulate monopolies and the failure to tax rentier income. If you read a book, Gustavus Myers, History of the Great American Fortunes, tells the story of how railroad and real estate monopolists were carved out at the expense of the economy at large. And the Democrats and Republicans alike in the 1990s said, we've got to prevent this these robber baron class. So they passed the Sherman Antitrust Law in 1890. Then came Teddy Roosevelt, the trustbuster, stopping them. And then came an introduction of the American income tax in 1913. And what was so unique about this tax is that it only fell on 2% of the Americans. Only the very rich had to file a tax return. And who were the very rich? They were the monopolists, they were the real estate magnates, and most of all, they were the bankers and the financiers who were trying to turn the economy into a trust economy and who were trying to fight against government regulation, against government policy to shape an industrial economy. And so what Trump admires in the 1890s and the late 19th century is everything that ended this whole century-long development of an industrial philosophy and policy to enrich America. So he's admiring the dismantling of the dynamic of monopolization, of financialization, of anti-government legislation that is the opposite of what made America rich. That's what makes all of this so ironic.
Richard, here is what Donald Trump said about the why has he decided to pause tariffs on some countries. And we know that China is not one of them.
Because you said that these tariffs would go into effect on Monday, you said no pause, and today there is a pause. So how can people believe your words today?
It's not a question of that. You have to have flexibility. I could say, here's a wall, and I'm going to go through that wall. I'm going to go through it no matter what, and keep going, and you can't go through the wall. Sometimes you have to be able to go under the wall, around the wall, or over the wall. These guys know that better than anybody, right? You got to go around them sometimes. You're not going to go through them. So I consider, you know, I think in financial markets, because they change. Look how much it changed today. We went from, pretty moderate today, but over the last few days, it looked pretty glum to, I guess they say it was the biggest day in financial history. That's a pretty big change. And I think the word would be flexible. You have to be flexible, like he's.
Richard, how do you characterize the U.S. donor class, as Michael was talking about, and its influence on policy?
Well, they seem to me to live in a fantasy world, that they can do things that clearly they can't do anymore. For me, the overwhelmingly interesting thing is, as I keep saying, that they live in a world in which the United States' economic, political, ideological, cultural, and military position are weakening. That's why the military strategists keep saying time is on China's side, not ours, in this conflict. But he doesn't want to face any of that. He's going to do this, that, and the other thing. No, he isn't. It isn't going to work for him. A declining empire does not have the options that a rising empire does. The last time we tried that with the tariffs was in a time of the rising U.S. empire. That's gone. That's over. We didn't have a major competitor of the on the scale that the Chinese are today back then. And by the way, Mr. McKinley got the tariff through when he was a representative. By the time he became a president, he turned against the policy of tariffs because he got into too much difficulty from the very class that Michael is talking about. Michael is right. There's no question that deep below all of the rest of this BS is a desire to avoid what for him is a catastrophe, which is the expiration of the tax cut that was passed in 2017. If that is allowed to expire, and that legislation has a self-ending, I believe on the 31st of December of this year. So if he doesn't get that problem solved, his donor class will get an enormous tax increase comparable to the one day decrease that they got 8 years ago. So he has to deal with that. And Michael is also right. He's promised more tax cuts on top of making sure that that other tax cut doesn't expire. And given that we are already projected to have almost a $2 trillion deficit now, he is looking at unbelievable risks of a bond market breakdown because people won't lend to the United States anymore because it's too dangerous to do. It is what happened to Liz Truss in England not so long ago. She tried to come up with a budget that looked like, oh, we will borrow more. No, said the bond market, we're not going to lend you anymore. And her proposal disappeared, and she disappeared. She's gone out of political politics, out of politics in Britain. I don't make predictions, but Mr. Trump, who has had in the long historical sweep of things a meteoric rise to the top, could very well now be on the cusp of an equally meteoric rise down into oblivion because this doesn't work. There is an element here that people should understand. To the degree that people and businesses around the world lower their prices in order to hold on to the American market, despite the tariffs, then Mr. Trump will have achieved at least a part of what he's after. He will have made the rest of the world pay a tribute to the United States, because that's what it is. You want to do business here, you pay us. And the way you pay us is you lower the price of your exports here. That way the American people can keep buying them, the price will not go up, and the revenues from the tariffs will be paid to the American government, and it will be at the expense of the foreigners. They don't want it. They will be looking to every way to evade it. They will be likely to be successful. So the end result is that Mr. Trump will get a small portion of the fantasy he thinks is waiting there for him. That's for me what's going on. And again, they only get it if the rest of the world pays tribute. And that is going to make every other leader receive the rage and the bitterness of all those other countries who are being required to pay that tribute. And that's a wellspring of hostility that makes the United States, not China, the world's rogue nation in everybody's mind, U.S. allies and enemies alike. This is an extraordinarily risky ploy to undertake.